This is the Santita Jackson Show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Santita Jackson Show. It's Thursday, the day before Friday, pre-Friday, February 25th, 2021. Where did the month go, everybody? It's almost March, and maybe spring is not too far away. I'm Santita Jackson. This is the Santita Jackson Show. Coming to you from AM 950 Radio in Minneapolis, St. Paul, the voice of progressive Minnesota, and from the largest progressive talk radio station in the nation, WCPT 820, took over the airwaves for Air America not too long ago, and we have been growing, 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 thanks to you and your support. I want you to call me or text me at 773-763-WCPT, 773-763-9278. GWC Injury Lawyers gives you the opportunity to text. I want you to meet my morning stars over here on the Santita Jackson and Friends page on Facebook and on YouTube, the Santita Jackson Show. Now, all my morning stars and everybody who's out there listening, please go to the Santita Jackson page, the Santita Jackson Show, excuse me, over on YouTube. Like and subscribe. We want to continue to grow the show. Thank you very much. Hello, Chaperl and Daphne and L. Stanley Davis and Barbara Renee Wright and Barbara Jean and Carol Soskin out there on the left coast and Samantha Banks, Daryl, Brian. Oh, my goodness. All my morning stars just love y'all so much. Barbara Renee Wright, all of you. Thank you so much for being with us today. We've got a lot to talk about, as we're streaming live on the Santita Jackson and Friends page, the Santita Jackson landing page. But if you want to be my friend, you really have to go to the Santita Jackson and Friends page, those personal pages, which I'd never intended to have, top out at 5,000. But please, please join me over on the Santita Jackson and Friends page. And, of course, the Reverend Jesse Jackson Senior page. I use that page, too. And then the Santita Jackson Show on YouTube, Twitter at Santita J. Everybody, Vicki Wells, Vanderlei down there in Brazil, sending you much love. Raphael down there in Brazil, sending all my brothers and sisters much love down there south of us, everybody. Got a lot to talk about today. We're going to have G. Flint Taylor, Fred Hampton's lawyer. He's going to be responding to a lot of what we're hearing about Judas and the Black Messiah. There are now papers that are being released that are showing the intelligence community, specifically the FBI's involvement officially in the assassinations of Mark Clark and Fred Hampton. Can't wait to talk with him about that. Of course, we're going to have COVID-19 update from Dr. Deborah Verholden. So much news about that that comes out every day, everybody, every day. And then we're going to talk about these poll numbers that show that Bernie Sanders is more popular than Biden and Harris. What does that mean for progressive politics? What does that mean as we see President Trump, former President Trump, reemerging on the scene? Indeed, he is going to, Romney says he's going to run again. So what does all of that mean? What does it mean for progressive politics? Have an all-star panel talking about that today on the Santita Jackson Show. So let us get to these headlines, Paul. Chicago, there will be a high of 39 degrees. It will be mostly sunny. Minneapolis, St. Paul, 36 degrees, sunny. The Dow closed up 424 points yesterday. The NASDAQ closed up 132 points. The S&P 500 closed up 44 points. Indeed, the Dow set a record, everybody, set a record. Main Street, Wall Street, disconnect, everybody. 4 minutes, 37 seconds. That is how close Texas came to a complete grid failure. Had it happened, the Electric Reliability Council of Texas says Texas would have been in the dark for weeks, if not longer. It could have been months long, everybody. Indeed, their CEO, Bill Magnus, said this was a devastating event. Power is essential to civilization. What would have happened if they had lost all power for weeks and perhaps months? Now there's a Texas utility customer who's suing ERCOT. That's who they are, their Electric Reliability Corporation, for $1 billion after his electric bill went past $9,000. Wow. And the company automatically withdrew $1,200 from her account. I mean, leaving people struggling. But of course, attorney C.K. Hoffler, the president of the National Bar Association, told us that when you sign these automatic withdrawal deals with your utility companies and with other companies, you're essentially signing a contract. So think about that, everybody. Think about that. Think about that. Think about that. Think about that. And indeed, now still, 3 million Texans are boiling water amid what people are calling a plumbing catastrophe, which becomes a public health crisis, everybody. Think about that today. Bernie Sanders, as I said, come from this YouGov poll from The Economist. Approval rating higher than Biden and Harris. What does that mean? The CDC report says that 68% of people who exercised indoors at one Chicago gym, contracted COVID-19. Wow. And indeed, federal rules are so hazy. Coronavirus infections, the variant strains that are quickly spreading around the United States, guess what? They're so confusing that the public health officials may merely know the county where a case has emerged, but they cannot do the kind of investigation and deliver the notifications to slow the spread. So they might know you have it, and they can't say anything. What do you think about that? And, of course, our prayers go out to the sister of D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser, who died of COVID-19 complications, everybody. It is real, and there was yet another George Floyd story. This time, a Filipino-American, a California Navy vet, died after police knelt on his neck amid a mental health crisis. Angelo Quinto called police on December 23rd after noticing her brother had been exhibiting signs of mental distress. That is Maria Quinto Collins. And her brother Angelo Quinto, after he'd been exhibiting signs of anxiety, depression, and paranoia in the months prior to his death, she said, "I trusted the police. I thought that they would just come in and be passive and not dangerous or a threat to her brother." Well, guess what? He was being held down on the floor by his mother and was beginning to calm down. Two officers who were not identified took him from his mother's arms as he allegedly said, "Please don't kill me." And guess what? They knelt on his neck and he died. Thinking of Angelo Quinto and that family today, we dedicate the show to them. Tiger Woods, the first responder, said the golfer seemed unaware of how gravely he was injured. It was shock because his injuries were horrific, everybody. Indeed, the breaks were so severe, they snapped the skin, completely broke his leg. Wow. Pastor Darius Brooks, the Grammy Award-winning, the iconic psalmist, singer-songwriter, producer from the Tommies. Of course, one of the great songs of modern gospel music, Your Will, is what's best for me. He's also the pastor of the Grace Central Church, and we are so excited. It's in Westchester, Illinois. I urge you to go to that church because you're going to get blessed. You're going to get blessed by the great Pastor Darius Brooks. Give us some good news today, Pastor Brooks.
Hey, Santita, I'm so excited to be on here with you. Hello, Chicago and the world. I'm excited to be on the Santita Jackson Show. Yes, sir! I'm so excited. And thank you so much for all that you do. And don't stop, because it's going to be a part of this message today. When God gets through, including all of us as individuals, where he brings the unity of his vision together, that's how this thing is going to make sense at the end of the day. Santita, Philippians 4:8 says, "Finally, my brethren," when God say brethren, he's talking about brothers and sisters, man and male and female, "whatsoever things are true, whatsoever things are honest, whatsoever things are just, whatsoever things are pure, whatsoever things are lovely, whatsoever things are admirable," he says, "if there be any virtue or if there be any praise, think on these things." And if I had to use a thought for today, it's important that daily we land on our feet. It's important that daily we land on our feet because of the promises of God. Finally means at the end of the day or at the end of a thing, not necessarily the end, but whatever we're dealing with daily. He says, finally, or the finale of that thing, he says, you must make sure how you're seeing things is true. You must make sure how you're seeing things is honest, right, pure, lovely, admirable. And often these things point to our position as individuals so we can have the strength to do what we need to do. So he wants us every day, when we get through with the turmoils and the cray-cray, to be able to land on our feet, get some sleep, get some strength, and get back up and do this thing again, because we're more than able. Okay? And then he calls us brother. This implies family. When God calls us brothers, it implies family. Now, be careful right here, though, because family is, to God, is not just a word. Man's definition of family is bloodline. God's definition of family are likelines. Yeah. So when God puts us around the right kind of people, it's not just what we think people are close to us. We start thinking alike. And he says where there is unity, there is strength. So when God is dealing with us with our thoughts, it starts as an individual first. And once we do the individual position, he orchestrates events and situations and or experiences to move us in his will, because in his will is where he has the answers to everything. That the finally of a thing or the finale of a thing, watch this, becomes his outcome with only like minds. That's why he says where there is unity, there is strength. It's like your show this morning, Santita. You inspire us with information and you tell us everything that's going on so we could think things through and put us in a position to get ready to work, because this thing can't happen without us working. But it first starts with our thoughts. It first starts with our hearts. And it first starts with us landing on our feet so we can be able to get those dumbbells and we can get those the word from God to strengthen us, to be able to make us strong enough to fight. We don't go down because the things that surrounds us, Santita. We go down because we won't use what's inside of us. We serve. When we serve, we must be at the pleasure of the visionary. So whoever you're serving, the visionary got that outcome. It's like parents. When you serve your parents, they say, I got your best interest at heart. So whoever we're serving, it has to be at the pleasure of the visionary. And Santita, at the end of the day, I know I read, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, and they that dwell therein. In other words, God is not in control. God is in charge. But he gives us the control to understand his word as an individual first. And then we surround ourselves with like minds, like Santita being my friend. I'm singing, and she telling people how the information that we need to be better. So he puts us around the right kind of people to get a big, huge job done, because he knows how this thing is going to end at the end of the day. When I get through listening to everyone else, my choice must fit me to make sense out of all that's going on and still land on my feet. When we please God, it doesn't matter who we displease. But when we displease God, it really doesn't matter who we please. God wants us, at the end of the day, not to be bombarded with a lot of things if we can't handle them with our hands. But once we understand how to be strong in him, use our thoughts properly, God wants us to land on our feet. I love you, Santita.
I love you, Pastor Darius Brooks, one of the great, great, this Grammy Award winner, but those are the world's gifts to him and his ministry. I'm just so glad that you have heeded the call to minister to people. And when you go to his church, Grace Central, you're going to love it. It's going to be a wonderful experience, because one of the things that I love about Pastor Brooks is that many people don't know that he grew up with a loving family, but he grew up in the midst of grinding poverty. But his mama put him in the church. And when you're around that family, you feel that. And he has taken people who are dealing with the same circumstances in which he found himself growing up, Dr. Deborah Furr Holden, and he lifts them up. And he's given
and turn
them
around.
That's right.
Yeah.
He's given them the example of his wonderful marriage.
Yeah, it's so true. It's my 15 brothers and sisters, 9 girls and 6 boys, same thing, 7 stepdaddies. But I am an advocate believer that if you transform the way you see things, your situation does not have to be the end result. God is really true. And I ain't talking about this religious place. I'm talking about a personal place where you utilize these tools. God doesn't teach rules, Santita. God gives tools. Rules can be broken. Tools work every time. And so he puts us around the right kind of people to be strengthened. Even while we're working hard, we're supposed to be around the right kind of people with the right kind of thoughts. Yes. And that Biden thing you was talking about, it's so true. You know, he got this thing. I'm excited, girl. Don't stop me, because I keep going.
Well, you know, hold on, because you know what? This is someone who I want you to bring to your church, Dr. Deborah Furr Holden, who's with us today. She gives us the word on health every day. And we've been in the midst of this pandemic. Oh, I know you do. That's why I'm bringing her up, Dr. Deborah Furr Holden. Dr. Deborah Furr Holden, associate dean.
Yes, I do.
Yes,
and
you
Washington.
Do. I love him. Now, wait. He has the most fabulous wife in. He has the most fabulous wife ever. But I'll tell another time about the time we saw you all on the date when we were all at Amistad. But Dr. Deborah Verholden, give us a word on COVID-19. This story continues. And, you know, and he does watch you every day, Dr. Deborah Verholden. Every day. And he's trying to figure out what he's going to do about his health because of what you tell him and his wife and his beautiful daughter, Dasha, one of my godchildren, every single day. Dr. Deborah Verholden, how you doing?
I'm doing all right. Y'all having too much fun this morning.
We are having fun.
Way too much fun.
Well, you talk to me. You give me a word. You go. COVID-19. Well, I don't even know where to begin every day with you because I just hear something new every night, overnight. I don't know.
Well, you're about to see Michigan in the news because we've done it again. We've come out, been transparent about our numbers and where we are. The Michigan COVID data dashboard is now up. Every single state needs this. Literally, 44% of the data is in race. So we can't even say the race of more than a million people who got the vaccine. 44% of the data is missing. I thought, this is crazy. Why aren't they collecting these basic demographic variables? Age, sex, race, gender, you know, all this kind of stuff, right? When I go to the doctor, I'm required to provide all of that and then some. I don't have to give my age. They want my exact date of birth. And they got to match exactly what my insurance company has or they'll deny the claim and then my doctor will come after me for the whole cost of the visit, right? So it's not that I don't think it's that people are denying or refusing to provide this information because we're all used to having to provide this type of information to access healthcare. This is not brand new. So I'm like, what is the problem? So then I download the data from the dashboard myself. Now you got to get it. For a person like me, that's where we want to be. But you all call data, I call summary statistics. People say, well, what does the data say? Or show me the data. Give you a statistic. No, people like me, a data file, the data is a data file with rows and columns that I can analyze myself and produce my own statistics from. So I get the data file. Here's the rub. How much data do you think is missing on gender in the same data? How much gender data do you think is missing?
I don't know.
Less than 0.1%.
How did that happen?
How much data do you think is missing on age?
How much?
Zero. Got age on every single one of the almost 2.5 million people in Michigan who've gotten the vaccine. So we don't have a data problem. We don't have a problem collecting this data. We don't have a problem getting it. We don't have a problem merging in other sources of data to be able to answer the question by age and by gender. Are we administering this vaccine to people who are eligible and who want it fairly and equitably? Literally 1,200 missing lines and a data file of 2.5 million vaccines are missing gender. Zero missing on age. Zero. 44% of the data are missing race, and 70% are missing ethnicity. I don't know. That don't seem right to me. I literally can't. And I've been asking myself all night, how is this possible? I did not realize that they have been collecting all of the other demographic data with no problem. They have age and gender for almost every single human being. Mm-hmm. So what's the difference? If you're going to ask somebody, how old are you? Okay, are you male or female? Why wouldn't you say, what race are you? Because if you want to be able to report out, oh, yes, we've served the right age group. Oh, yes, we've served men and women equally, well, you would have to answer, you'd have to collect that information. If you don't want to be accountable for it, not answer the question, have you equitably distributed this or administered this to racial, ethnic minorities, black people, brown people, Hispanic people, then the easiest thing to do would be just don't collect the data. So it just literally, and then insult to injury, the Republican senators in our state, and I'm saying this because I really think people need to be on the lookout in their own state, and this to me is just unavoidable, preventable, and completely deplorable. The Republican governors are trying to monkey around with a bill that would say, well, and right now it's focused on these vaccines, but it could have implications for all kinds of COVID resources, including the new stimulus package that's coming. The governor said, well, you know what? We know that there's within these eligible categories for vaccines, there's some need to further prioritize. And so they picked two things. They picked race, and then they said, we've got this really robust measure called the Social Vulnerability Index, which is a measure that is sort of, I guess, ratified by the CDC. But it uses basically 15 census variables to identify communities that may have higher economic deprivation or greater risk for poor health outcomes in the residents. They said within the eligibility category, we're going to send more vaccines to communities that are higher on social vulnerability index or that have more racial ethnic minorities. They voted across the party line to amend that aspect. They said you will not use social vulnerability or race to determine any priority for who gets this vaccine. It's a whole mess. The light is being shined on a lot of problems that predated COVID.
And that is, and you know what? And that is why you're here, because we have got to deal with this. I want you to answer Joyce Anderson's question during the break, because she wants to know, if you've had COVID-19 and have taken the first shot, are you required to take the second shot? You have 30 seconds.
You're not required to take the second shot at all. Both shots are optional. So you're not required. But I guess the question is, when did you have COVID? If you got COVID, those antibodies we know are good for 90 days. After those 90 days, you will, if you want the vaccine, that is when you would get it. But if you're still within your 90-day window of having COVID, I would not get the vaccine. That might be too much for your immune system.
Hey, now see, that's important. That's important to know. Joyce, did that help you? Stay right here, everybody. We're going to be talking with G. Flint Taylor, Fred Hampton's lawyer. There are new revelations coming out about who killed Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, who assassinated them. And it turns out the FBI have been implicated. More of the Santita Jackson Show in just a few minutes.
This is the Santita Jackson Show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Santita Jackson Show. At the top of the hour, we're going to be talking about the Biden administration. Bernie Sanders is more popular. He has a higher approval rating as he fights for raising the minimum wage and on and on and on and on. What is that saying? What does that say about progressive politics? What does it say that former President Trump is gearing up to run again in 2024? But right now, you know, many of us, we've been dealing with a lot. We've been having a lot of revelations about many, 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 many issues that have been lingering with us for years. And the story that just won't go away, the story that won't go away, and it shouldn't, is the assassination of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, December of 1969. And this gentleman has been with this story since the beginning. Fred Hampton's lawyer, the people's law office here in Chicago. Attorney G. Flint Taylor has just spent his life. If you have had your back against the wall, this is the person you go to, someone for whom we have so much love and admiration and respect. When it was unpopular to do so, I think people have to remember, or at least know, that Fred Hampton and the Black Panthers were public enemies number one. That fertilize the soil in which he was assassinated. So we want to talk about, with this new movie, Judas and the Black Messiah, there's a renewed interest in Fred Hampton and in the forces that killed him. And Mark Clark. Let us not forget Mark Clark, who was killed first, trying to guard Fred Hampton, Chairman Fred, in his home, and his fiancée, who was pregnant with their son, 8 months pregnant with this baby at that time. And so we welcome you back to the show. You're part of the Santita Jackson family, Attorney G. Flint Taylor. The headlines say a whole lot. Assassinated by the state in these times. New documents suggest J. Edgar Hoover was involved in Fred Hampton's murder. J. Edgar Hoover's role in the killing of two Black Panthers demands a reckoning from the Chicago Sun-Times. And on and on and on it goes. Take us back 40 years. Who was Fred Hampton? Where were you? How did this all play out? Well, 52 years. Take us back 52 years. How did this all play out then? And where are we now?
Well, that's a story in and of itself, of course, Santita, and thank you for having me, and I'm proud to be part of the Santita Jackson family, as you put it.
Yes.
Fred Hampton, of course, was a marvelous young 21-year-old leader of the Black Panther Party here in Chicago in 1969, and he was targeted not only by the Chicago police and not only by the state's attorney of Cook County at that time, Edward V. Hanrahan, but as it was later uncovered in our lawsuit and other investigations, he was targeted by J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI and its Racial Matters Squad here in Chicago. And in November and December of 1969, that led to his assassination and the murder of Mark Clark on the early morning of December 4th. And as we later learned, that there was an FBI informant provocateur named William O'Neill that was behind the raid, who drew a floor plan of the apartment to show where Fred Hampton would be, and that was transmitted by the FBI, specifically Roy Martin Mitchell of the FBI here in Chicago, to Hanrahan and the 14 police officers who went to the apartment at 4:30 in the morning and shot Fred Hampton while he was apparently drugged in the back bedroom while he slept in the very bed that O'Neill had charted. And over the years, after we brought a lawsuit and fought the case in court for some 13 years, we were able to establish and document that this raid was part of the FBI's COINTELPRO program, that they, in fact, not only had set up the raid, but that, in fact, they had rewarded O'Neill after the fact with a bonus, $300 or 30 pieces of silver, as we called it, because that's what Judas got. And that's when we started to call O'Neill Judas and liken him to Judas, of course, who set up Jesus. And so after 13 years, it seemed like the record was complete, that the assassination was part of COINTELPRO, that Fred was murdered because he was a great young Black leader, a messiah, as Hoover had called Dr. King and Malcolm X and others before him who had been targeted by the COINTELPRO program. And that narrative was fixed, it seemed, until recently when we got access to additional documents that kind of cemented the fact that not only was this a local FBI project with the tacit approval of Hoover and his high-level underlings in Washington, but that, in fact, they knew O'Neill was operating, and that not only did they approve of a bonus for O'Neill for his success in setting up the raid, but they also rewarded the FBI agent, Roy Martin Mitchell, for his role in it. So the documentary evidence through a Freedom of Information Act request some 30, 40, 50 years later after our trial shows even more directly the involvement of Hoover himself and his top aides, William C. Sullivan and George Moore.
Why is there a push now And why is this story relevant today? I mean, we've seen, interestingly, a more of a discussion about the FBI's role. I mean, was that a was that part of the discussion 50 years ago, or is that relatively new?
Well, it was all coming out post-Watergate. Fred was murdered in 1969. Watergate unraveled in 73, 74. And so there was a focus in Washington on investigating the intelligence agencies because of their involvement in all these activities. And so the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, and other intelligence and counterintelligence agencies within the government were investigated. So at the same time we were litigating this lawsuit in the mid-70s, the Frank Church Senate Committee was looking into the FBI and its COINTELPRO program. And so we were working kind of hand-in-hand with them, and they were giving us information they were uncovering, and we were giving them information that they were that we were uncovering. And that all led to a report in 1976, right during the time that we were in the middle of trial, in which the Senate Committee itself found that the COINTELPRO program was designed to destroy, and that's their language, the Black Panther Party, and that the raid was part of that COINTELPRO program. So in the 70s, there was a great deal of focus on the assassination of Fred Hampton and the newly uncovered evidence that the FBI was behind and integral to the assassination of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark.
Why is it relevant today? Should we be concerned or interested or both?
Of course, it's my feeling, and I'm sure you would agree with me, that it's highly relevant today. It's always relevant to understand the depths that the government will go in pursuing illegal and unconstitutional actions against leaders, particularly in the African-American community, particularly leaders who are in the forefront of the Black liberation struggle. It's important to bring all that evidence out. We see in the last week or two new evidence surfacing in the Malcolm X assassination. As not only as people who continue to fight these battles, but as people who help to bring that evidence to light and to bring the true narrative, the people's narrative, as it were, about what happened in these cases. If left to their own measures, we'd still be thinking that there was a police shootout the Panthers engaged in with the police in 1969. If it hadn't been for the community and hadn't been for the fight of all the people uncovering the evidence, that narrative wouldn't have shifted from a shootout to a shoot-in to a murder to an assassination.
Well,
and so if we got...
Tell us how that narrative shifted. When it first... Well, I guess it would be December 4th, 1969, when we awakened to the news that there had been a shootout and the Black Panthers lost. Please explain what happened, how the perception then, and how that changed over time.
Well, remarkably, the police left the apartment open, and that's how I started my work on the case. Within hours of the murders of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark, I was called to the apartment by the lawyers I worked with at the People's Law Office, and we started to document the crime scene. And the crime scene had all these bullet holes that were caused by machine guns and shotguns and other weapons by the police, and you could actually chart where those bullets came from and where they went. And you could also see the blood on the mattress where Fred Hampton was sleeping and on the floor where they dragged his body. And so we took all this evidence. We filmed all of it. We took pictures of all of it. And we did that for 10 days. And at the same time, the Panthers took the community on tours through that apartment and showed those bullet holes and showed where they came from and showed that bed where Fred Hampton died and with his blood on it.
And so the media at first bought the story of the police and of Hanrahan that it was a shootout and that the Panthers fired 100 shots, and they thought they could get away with that. And perhaps if they'd sealed up that apartment, they might have been able to get away with it. But they weren't able to get away with it because the crime scene itself and the Panthers and we who were working in that crime scene to show what really happened, changed the narrative. And it changed the narrative early on from a shootout to a shoot-in. But it wasn't until the lawsuit that we brought in the 70s and the revelations that came from that that we were able to show that not only was it not a shootout, but it was a shoot-in, but we were able to show that Fred was shot in the head, and we could show who the cop was who had the gun who shot him in the head. So we were able to show it was a murder. And, of course, by that time, we had shown that he had drugs in his system and knew that he had been drugged because he didn't use drugs. So he was sleeping at the time, shot in the head. So now it's a murder. But at the same time, we're showing that it was a political assassination by the FBI because we're uncovering these documents in the FBI's own handwriting, so as it were, that showed that it was part of COINTELPRO, that O'Neill set it up with a floor plan, and that he received the bonus for it, and that they covered that up for years. And so that was the narrative that we were showing in court, and that the Panthers were talking about publicly. And so that's how in those 13 years that the fight went on actively, that we changed that narrative.
Chaparral Wells wants to know, is there anyone alive today who could be charged with these murders? Because it was Fred Hampton and Mark Clark who were murdered that morning.
You know, that's a very good question. And Mrs. Hampton, to her dying day many years, I guess it's now 3 years ago when Mrs. Hampton passed, she always said that. She, you know, even though we had established what I just spoke of to her, it was completely unacceptable that they hadn't been charged with murder. They were, after a tremendous uproar in the community over several years, Hanrahan and the cops were charged with obstruction of justice and conspiracy. But the grand jury, which was fixed by Cook County powers that be, a daily machine, voted 10-10 whether to indict for murder or not. And, of course, 10-10, you have to get more than 10 votes in a grand jury, which is 23 persons, to get an indictment. So Hanrahan and his men were tried, actually, for obstruction of justice in 1972, and a machine judge on the eve of a 1972 election acquitted them so that Hanrahan, who was up for re-election, could say, "I was acquitted." But, of course, the community was so outraged that for the first time en masse, African-American folks voted for Republican. Bernie Carey voted Hanrahan out of office, and that political base formed the basis for the election of Harold Washington 10 years later. And some say it had a real impact on the election of Obama, you know, a couple of decades after that. So I don't know if any of the main participants in the murder. Hanrahan's gone. I think most of the raiding officers are gone. Actually, one isn't, because I ran into him as a witness in the Jackie Wilson torture case. He went on to work for John Burge, believe it or not. And he's still alive. He couldn't testify. He was so incapacitated mentally. So I don't think there's any living targets of a murder investigation now. I think, though, that politically, many victories were won, changing the narrative, voting Hanrahan out of office, getting Harold elected. All those kind of things can be claimed as the legacy of the murder of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark.
And so much happened behind that, because just behind that, you had Bill Singer and Reverend Jackson, who unseated the Daley delegation at the 72 convention just right after that. And there was so much political activity that was aroused by the assassinations of Fred Hampton and Mark Clark. And we just kept on going. Where are we today with this? I mean, are there any new revelations that we're beginning to see? Because now, you know, we have this movie. Now we see the Shabazz family who are coming forward, because, you know, you had this NYPD police officer who said, "I'm confessing, and I don't want this to come out until I'm dead."
But I'm confessing.
What do we know now?
Well, the Malcolm situation was something that, of course, was in the spotlight in the 60s and 70s, along the same time as the assassination of Fred Hampton. And what's coming out now kind of supplements what's been coming out over the years, which is that Malcolm, that two of the three people who were charged with assassinating Malcolm in the ballroom in February of 1965 were, in fact, innocent. And one man was guilty, and he ultimately named four others who were co-conspirators with him from the mosque in Newark. Of course, there was a tremendous rivalry between the Nation of Islam and Malcolm and Malcolm's organization, because Malcolm had split from the Nation. So the FBI and the police, the intelligence division of the New York Police Department, was all up into the split, into the same way as they were with Fred Hampton, in trying to make the war between the two organizations to exacerbate that. And as time's gone on, it's been shown that there were nine FBI informants in that crowd when Malcolm was speaking, and that not only was the man who gave Malcolm mouth-to-mouth resuscitation and was the head of his security a police informant, but now the man who's come forward with the deathbed letter also says he worked for the New York Police Department's Intelligence Division, that he was present, and that he was involved in framing up several of Malcolm's people in a case, in a bogus case, which led them away from the ballroom so they couldn't supply security, and that the Intelligence Division of the New York Police Department also and the New York Police Department did not provide security for that speaking engagement. So that allowed for the assassination of Malcolm by people who worked and were in the Nation of Islam. And so you see the parallels, although we don't have the FBI actually the fingerprints that we have in the same way that we have in the Hampton case. We see that both the COINTELPRO program of the FBI and the Intelligence Division of the New York Police Department was deeply involved in surveilling and setting up the cases in Malcolm's situation, and that they stayed silent when two innocent men went to the penitentiary, and that four of the five men who were involved have never been brought to justice. And we don't know if any of those four worked for either the FBI or the New York Police Department. So there's still unanswered questions. But what we do know is that COINTELPRO was very much focused on Malcolm and Elijah Muhammad and the division between the two organizations, and that they very much, along with the New York Police Department's intelligence division, wanted to exacerbate that split, and were happy, like they were when Fred Hampton was assassinated, when Malcolm was assassinated, because they knew Malcolm was a tremendous threat in terms of the politics that he was espousing and the leadership he was showing. And in many ways, he was, Fred Hampton was a lot like Malcolm X in terms of how uncompromising he was in what he said and his politics and what he said about a necessity of fighting back against the police and also against the war in Vietnam as it was just developing when Malcolm in 1965 when Malcolm was assassinated.
Congressman Bobby Rush, where was he in all of this? Because he was a very prominent member of the Black Panthers, and he barely escaped being killed himself.
He did. He went home that night to his wife and their apartment, rather than stayed at the apartment where Fred was assassinated. And then, as you know, they said to one of the Panther survivors and who passed it on to Jeff Hobbs, my partner at the law office, who was also involved with Skip Andrew and Dennis Cunningham and many others in responding to the assassination, said, Rush is next. And so Rush then, and they did raid Rush's apartment the next night, but Rush wasn't there. And as you know, he ultimately turned himself in with your dad a few days after that. I believe it at Operation Breadbasket.
Well, first at our apartment. they went out looking at my parents' apartment. My brothers and I were like 6'5" and 4". And because he was the most wanted man in America at that for that moment. Do we really, I have about 2 minutes left here. Do we really understand all of the good that the Panthers were doing and the threat that they were to the establishment?
Well, I think that that you can't emphasize too much their 10-point program, and you can't emphasize too much that they were the Breakfast for Program, Children Program, the medical clinic that was established, the newspaper that they put out, and the fact that they were trying to bring together all of the different organizations, whether it be street organizations or whether it be the Young Lords in the Puerto Rican community, the Young Patriots in the Uptown community, to bring them together in a rainbow coalition well before your dad popularized the concept in the 80s. And yes, and I think that there's a new movie now, but people need to go back to the original movie, The Murder of Fred Hampton, and they need to go back to The Eyes on the Prize if they want to see really the most dynamic film of the actual Fred Hampton and of the actual Black Panthers. I think both of those films, which are on the Internet, very, very instructive and important for young people to see, to get a full flavor of Fred Hampton and who he was and what he meant to everyone back then and what he now means to many people today.
Attorney Flint Taylor, is there anything you'd like to say in the last minute before we go?
Well, once again, I'm very pleased to be with you, and I think that we have to continue to uncover the true nature and the complete record with regard to these cases, Fred Hampton case as well as the Malcolm X case. Bobby Rush has said that he's going to ask the Biden administration to have an open file policy with regard to the Fred Hampton case and the Panthers. And hopefully Biden will do that. And I think that my sense is that the Malcolm X's family will do the same, and that that people who are wrongfully convicted in the Malcolm X case, they need to be fully exonerated, even though one of them has passed and the other is out of jail. And that's what we need to do as historians, as activists. And we need to bring that message to the young people so that they understand their history and they understand that, in fact, this could happen again and that we need to defend our movements today in the same way that we defended them back then.
Attorney G. Flint Taylor. The People's Law Office, everybody, the People's Lawyer, Fred Hampton's lawyer. We just love and appreciate you for all that you have done and continue to do, fighting for our rights. Going to be talking about the Biden-Harris administration. Did you know Bernie Sanders is more popular? Oh, more of the Santita Jackson Show in just a few minutes.
This is the Santita Jackson Show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome, welcome, welcome to the Santita Jackson Show. It's Thursday, February 25th, 2021. I'm coming to you from the largest progressive talk radio station in the United States, WCPT 820 in Chicago, AM 950 Radio, the voice of progressive Minnesota. My family to the north in Minneapolis, St. Paul. It's a joy to be with you. Please join me on the Santita Jackson and Friends page on Facebook and on the Santita Jackson page and on Reverend Jesse Jackson's page and on our new YouTube channel, the Santita Jackson Show. So everybody, please go over there and like and subscribe, like and subscribe. And, Lorraine, I'm hanging tough. You're such a sweetie. Paula and Hannah and Kenneth and Bab and Jewel and Chaperl and, oh my goodness, all of our brothers and sisters down there in Brazil listening to us. I thank you so much and watching. I'm sending you much love, Jewel, and give them the embrace. Make them know the love. And they do. They're all part of the Morning Stars. They keep coming back day after day after day. Vandalay and Raphael and everyone, I want to thank you so much for being with us and bringing more people along with you. We're mindful of the fact that that you get up and you're dealing with the same issues in Brazil that we're dealing with here. And we're dealing with them all over the world, and we like to talk about them. We're going to talk about some issues, some stories that are happening, down in Brazil as well, so we can pull this global community for justice together. Everybody, Chicago has a high of 39 degrees. It will be mostly sunny. Minneapolis, St. Paul, 36 degrees, sunny. The Dow closed up 424 points yesterday. Indeed, they set a record, yet another. The NASDAQ closed up 132 points. The S&P 500 closed up 44 points. I want you to call or text me at 773-763-WCPT, 773-763-9278. Let's get a few headlines in on the Santita Jackson Show. 4 minutes. 37 seconds. That is how close Texas came to a complete grid failure. That news comes from the Electric Reliability Council of Texas. Their chairman and CEO, Bill Magnus, discussed the events that led to this power outage. He said this was a devastating event. Power is essential to civilization. And had they not rescued the system, it would have been a statewide blackout that would have lasted weeks, if not months, everybody. What do you think about that? How could something like that happen? 3 million people, at least in Texas, are still having to boil their water. They're dealing with a catastrophe that we're not really covering now because some of the power is on. But the pain remains, everybody. COVID-19, more than 504,000 Americans have died. We are 20%, 4% of the world, but 20% of the deaths. How is that happening? And this is a very interesting story. Federal rules around who can be told about the variant cases are so confusing, everybody, that the public health officials may merely know the county where a case has emerged, but they can't do the kind of investigation and deliver the notifications needed to slow the spread, which goes back to what Dr. Deborah Verholden was saying. When you don't collect all the information and these rules, you might not know that you have it. No one's going to tell you. How about that? There's a Chicago gym, according to the CDC, a gymnasium. 68% of the people who exercised indoors at the Chicago gym in August contracted COVID-19. I know people are trying to get back into the gym to get in shape, but there's something to be said for that. We had yet another George Floyd incident. Angelo Quinto, a Filipino-American California Navy veteran who was having some mental health issues, according to his family, and he was struggling, as so many people do, and his family called in the police, and they felt that the police would protect him. No, they did not do that. They put him down on his stomach with his legs crossed behind him, and one officer allegedly placed his knee on his neck. At this point, according to the lawsuit, Mr. Quinto, the former California Navy vet, the Navy vet, started bleeding from his mouth. At no time while being restrained did he resist physically or verbally. After being restrained for almost 5 minutes, he became lifeless. Sending love to the family of Angelo Quinto today. He was only 30 years of age. Tiger Woods, on the mend, but it's going to be a long and difficult recovery. He did not know how gravely he was injured. In fact, because of shock, they said he might not have felt the pain, but he's feeling it today. The injuries were so profound that his leg was completely broken and the bone broke through the skin. Wow. Wow. Not going to fly. Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal from Washington, one of the leading progressives in Congress, warns Democrats against using the advice of unelected parliamentarian as an excuse not to pass the $15 wage gap. And everybody, a new record, an estimated 18 million Americans identify as LGBTQ+. What do you think about that, everybody? What do you think about that? And UCLA, times they are changing. They have put two HBCUs on their future football schedules. What? They will host Alabama State September 10th, 2022, and North Carolina Central on September 16th, 2023 at the Rose Bowl. Oh, what a time, what a time that is going to be, everybody. Let's get right to it. You know, Dave Daly, who is part of the family on this show, reminds us that even though we have a 50-50 split in the U.S. Senate, 50 Democrats, 50 Republicans, those numbers are deceptive. The fact is the 50 senators on the Democratic side represent 41 million more Americans than the Republicans do. Let me say that again. The 50-50 split in the U.S. Senate is deceptive. The Democrats represent, the 50 Democrats represent 41 million more Americans than the Republicans. So is it surprising to you that this economist YouGov poll says that that Bernie Sanders' approval rating is higher than Biden's as he champions minimum wage and stimulus checks and the things that Americans need? We've got a tremendous panel to talk with us about that today. Of course, we are led by Frank Watkins, the co-author of A More Perfect Union, Advancing New American Rights. He wrote that with Congressman Jesse Jackson, Jr. Indeed, he's been Reverend Jesse Jackson's communications director for more than 50 years. And he has been really, he's one of the architects of his presidential campaigns. Of course, we welcome Frank Watkins back to the show. From the National Conference of Black Lawyers, we've got Mark Fancher, Attorney Mark Fancher, and then Attorney Robert Petillo, the Southeastern Regional Director for Rainbow Push, and he hosts his own show every Sunday on WAOK, the iconic Black Talk radio station in Atlanta, every Sunday from 1 to 4 Eastern Standard Time, 12 to 3 Central Standard Time for Bab and Carol out there on the left coast. That's 10 to 1 p.m. Welcome to the show, everybody. Okay, Frank Watkins, what do you make of this news that Bernie Sanders, he has this popularity, and his popularity actually at this point is outdistancing that of the Biden-Harris administration? What say you?
I'm not sure I've seen the movie. I guess it's a classic movie. Casablanca, is that where they, the famous line, there's gambling in Casablanca? I'm not surprised. I think it's the difference between someone who is advocating for raising the minimum wage, advocating for the $1.9 trillion rescue package, and someone who is fighting for it. And I think people prefer fighters. I was thinking this morning, if when you were growing up, Santita, and a bully came up and was bothering you and so forth, and your friend said, don't worry, Santita, I'll stand by you. And or you had a friend who said, if you lay one hand on her, you know, I'm going to kick your butt. Which person would you rather have on your side?
The ride or die.
defending you against the bully.
Yes.
Well, it's the same thing here. You've got Jen Psaki, his press secretary, when asked about the minimum wage, she said Biden was standing by raising the minimum wage. Biden also said he wasn't sure that the minimum wage would survive, you know, through the Senate. We may have to pass the bill without the minimum wage because the parliamentarian may rule against it. No. You fight for raising the minimum wage, and if the parliamentarian rules against it, you put the blame on the parliamentarian. but you fight. And you're correct. I saw Representative Rokana saying the same thing, that you should not allow the parliamentarian to stop you. The vice president can overrule the parliamentarian. It's been done in the past, and we need, you know, the $1.9 trillion package with the minimum wage in it. So whatever the parliamentarian says, there's a precedent for ignoring, in this case, her. And, you know, moving on with the bill. So the idea that Bernie Sanders is more popular than Biden and Harris does not surprise me at all. I don't know whether the poll included Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez or not, but I would imagine she would be more popular as well, because she's a fighter. As a matter of fact, on the opposite side, one of the reasons why Trump has such loyalty in his base is they perceive him as fighting for them. I don't think that's the case, but that's their perception, that he's fighting for them, and if he's fighting for them, they're going to stick by him. And that's what is happening with Bernie Sanders as well, in my judgment.
We're talking with Frank Watkins in this wonderful panel, the author, co-author of A More Perfect Union, Advancing New American Rights, Reverend Jesse Jackson's communications director for more than 50 years, brilliant architect, really, of the modern civil rights movement. We're joined by... Let me go to you, Attorney Mark Fancher, National Conference of Black Lawyers. Are you surprised by this higher approval rating by Bernie Sanders as he's championing minimum wage, as he's championing fighting for stimulus checks, as he's really fighting for $2,000 a month for every American household? Does it surprise you?
No, not at all. And I think that Frank Watkins is right on the money in terms of the reason. But, you know, I also think that it goes beyond just the fight that's being waged for minimum wages. And it just extends to the broader political orientation of so many people in this country. You know, I think that, you know, if you take a look at the difference between a politician and a revolutionary, a politician is someone who tries to run and catch up with where the people are. And once he reaches the people, he says, I'm here too. A revolutionary looks at where the people are going, runs out ahead of them, and tries to figure out ways to get them to their destination faster. And so I think that you have people who are moving very quickly toward an objective of socialism for this country. And, you know, there are only those politicians who recognize that that's where they're going and who are doing what they can to try and get them there faster, who are going to receive the type of recognition and approval of the people themselves. But I also think that it highlights the contradiction of the system that you have politicians who are the only ones who are able to get elected to office, and the people who really are standing in front of the people and helping them to get where they're trying to go, urging them on, those are the people who can't get elected. And it just speaks to the extent to which the system has been rigged, and the extent to which I think increasingly the people are going to have to reject both the Democratic and the Republican parties, because they're both locked into a system that serves, capitalism and the corporate class.
Attorney Robert Battillo, a Southeastern Regional Director for Rainbow Push and a host of your own radio show on WAOK in Atlanta every Sunday from 1 to 4 Eastern Standard Time. Are you surprised by these findings from this poll?
Well, no, because the backup quarterback is always the most popular player on the team. The next head coach, you know, the new hot offensive coordinator is always the most popular choice for being the next head coach. Bernie has the benefit of being a pure ideologue. He has the benefit of not having to worry about building a political coalition. Bernie doesn't have to worry about trying to find 51 votes. He doesn't have to persuade Joe Manchin or Kristen Sinema to come across party lines or think about the idea of getting Lisa Murkowski or Susan Collins or Ben Sasse or Mitt Romney potentially to cross party lines in order to vote in favor of something. He doesn't have to think about how this will impact the confirmation of a federal judge in 2 years that he might elect if he makes a Republican chairman of a committee angry. So yes, he has the benefit of simply being able to be very declarative on issues, to speak clearly, because he doesn't actually have to worry about actualizing them and putting them into action. What we see a lot of the times is that new, hot quarterback that you are really looking forward to getting into the game. You know, we got to get Nick Foles out of here and get Trubisky in there. Then about six games in, you say, hey, let's get Trubisky back out of there and get Foles back in there because this isn't working. So I think once they if you put these things to the test and put them into governance, then of course these things become less popular. Think about how popular Gavin Newsom was when he was the mayor of San Francisco versus Gavin Newsom as the governor of California, where they're trying to recall him. Because sometimes, ideologically, once you try to put those things into legislative action, it's a lot harder to actually govern than it is to put forth policy proposals that sound like they will work very well for people. So I think part of what you're seeing is the benefit of not having to compromise, being able to be very clear on what you would and would not do. And just as Mark said, this is similar to that Trump effect, where Republicans got so used to equivocating and quivering politicians who talked about what they couldn't do. Trump just came in and said what I'm going to do, and whether it makes sense or not, they enjoyed the strength. You know, Americans are born and bred on John Wayne, on Dirty Harry, on Ronald Reagan, and this idea of a strong man just getting things done. That's just not how the American parliamentary system works, where one person has that iconoclastic ability to do such. So I think Bernie has to start demonstrating the ability to get some of these ideas across the finish line. And I think that's when the true rubber meets the road, when Bernie is able to convince a Susan Collins to vote in favor of $15 minimum wage, when he's able to talk a Lisa Murkowski into supporting Medicare for all. I think that's when the rubber hits the road, but as long as you're the backup quarterback, it's always easy to be very popular.
Well, Frank Watkins, do you think that argument could be made more persuasively if we had politics that reflected where the people are? That is to say, if 50 of the Democrats in the U.S. Senate represent 41 million more votes, doesn't that give these progressive positions, or certainly the Democratic Party, an edge, or shouldn't it?
Well, it should.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Well,
Robert,
and then you, Frank.
Sorry about that. I said it should, but what Republicans have figured out is how to work the refs so that they can, where you can have 15 Republican senators representing fewer people than the population of California, or where they don't have to win the popular vote but once every 30 or 40 years and still maintain power. So it should work out that way, but it just doesn't.
Frank? And then you, Mark.
I was going to say that I partially agree and partially disagree with what Attorney Petillo is saying. I agree with him to the extent that Biden has a rough job, and he's thinking about how to get the 51 votes. But so is Bernie Sanders. Here's where I have the difference. Bernie Sanders' strategy is that he thinks we can get the 51 votes by mobilizing the American people and putting so much pressure on the politicians that we can get the 51 votes. So there's a different strategy associated with what Biden has to do and what Bernie Sanders is trying to do. Bernie Sanders is trying to get public support for a progressive agenda, which will aid Biden in achieving his 41 votes. So I think 51 votes. I think both of them have in mind, you know, the 51 votes. They just have different strategies, and they're playing a different role in achieving that.
Mm. Well, what do you think, Attorney Mark Fancher? Do you think that these politics would be changed if the numbers were different, and if Democrats behaved as if they represent 41 million more people in the U.S. Senate than the Republicans?
Santita, if I could give one other example, if you remember, sure. Biden defeated Bernie, I think it was something like 80 to 20% in Mississippi,
mm-hmm.
you know, in terms of the vote. I mean, he just swamped him. He buried him. It was ridiculous. On the other hand, over 50% of the people supported Bernie's Medicare for All.
Mm-hmm.
So they liked what he was saying, but
they trusted Biden, right? I mean, because once
at one level, and they had so damaged the idea of democratic socialism that mm-hmm. People were afraid to vote for what they really wanted because of a name.
Wow. Mark, I've got about 90 seconds.
Yeah, no, I think we've got to take this completely out of the electoral politics paradigm. I really don't care what the politicians do or what they're capable of doing, because they're not capable of doing very much. The system constrains and confines them. They can't do very much. I don't care where their hearts are. I don't care where their analysis is. I don't care where their convictions are. It's rigged. And we have to think more about what we as people can do to change the political situation in this country, not how we can get more votes, how we can get more influence. All of that is folly, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, you know, we really have to think in revolutionary terms about how the broad masses of the people can re-envision what politics means in this country, and how their actual will, how their actual convictions, their actual aspirations and objectives can be made manifest. Because this system ensures only that the interests of major corporations are going to be served. You can spin a lot of rhetoric. You can do all kinds of things. You can make all kinds of proclamations and plans. Mm-hmm. But you're never going to realize the true aspirations of the people in this system.
Not until you think very differently and behave very differently. There's got to be a cultural shift. There's got to be a shift.
Exactly.
It has to be an absolute shift in order for things to change. It's a bipartisan betrayal, but we can turn that around. We're going to talk about that on the Santita Jackson Show back in just a few minutes.
This is the Santita Jackson Show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome. Welcome back to the Santita Jackson Show. Have a tremendous panel as we're talking about this Economist YouGov poll that shows that Bernie Sanders' approval rating is higher than the Biden-Harris administration, as he is championing minimum wage and stimulus checks. Of course, we have Reverend Frank Watkins, the co-author of the book, A More Perfect Union, Advancing New American Rights. He wrote that, co-wrote that, of course, with Congressman Jesse Jackson, Jr. And we have the National Conference of Black Lawyers.
Yes. And, we're reissuing that in a 20th anniversary edition in the not too distant future.
I can't wait to have you both on to talk about it. Maybe I can rouse my brother to come on here and talk about it, because it really is a tremendous book. But certainly I will have you on here to talk about that. Can't wait to see the reissuing of that book. Of course, from the National Conference of Black Lawyers, Attorney Mark Fancher, and, of course, Southeastern Regional Director for Rainbow Push. Rainbow Push Atlanta, that is Attorney Robert Petillo, host of his own show on WAOK, the iconic Black Talk radio station in Atlanta, every Sunday from 12 to 3 Central Standard Time, 1 to 4 Eastern Standard Time. You can hear his show. And, of course, we're joined by our friend, everyone's friend here. Indeed, he was head of the ACLU of South Carolina, the co-author and co-editor of the book, Killing Trayvon's An Anthology of American Violence, brilliant writer, thinker, and, of course, he was the organizer of chaired Reverend Jackson's campaigns in South Carolina, historic campaigns in South Carolina in 84 and 88. Kevin Gray, welcome back to the show. What do you make of this YouGov Economist poll that says Bernie Sanders' approval rating is higher than Biden and Harris?
Well, I think people are looking for a different structure and a different way of life. And the senator offers the only challenge, I think, to status quo. We talk about minimum wage and free public education and paying off student debt, housing. I mean, there are a lot of things that people really see a need for, and they're trying to figure out just how to do it, how to survive going forward. What's this new economy going to look like? And I think Senator Sanders offers a glimpse at what a new economy will look like. I agree with Frank. I think we have to evolve into something, and into a revolutionary state. And in order to do that, it first takes organizing. When you talk about the courts and gerrymandering and representation, not only in Congress but on the local level, it takes organizing, and that's the key element in doing anything. I mean, and it can't be organizing just for political season. It has to be organizing for change. When you talk about gerrymandering, you got to talk about people going into the room and arguing and putting up a fight about the unfairness of the lines that are drawn, not just, as I said, not just on the national level, but on the state level. And so, you know, while Senator Sanders is popular, we still have to keep our eye on the prize, and that's how do you pull off this local organizing.
Why do you continue to go back to organizing, Kevin?
I mean, because it's got to happen on the ground. All politics are local, and you've got to get people involved, and you've got to educate people as to how the process works. And you've got to have people challenging power every day, as I said, not just on an election cycle. And you know, right now, you know, we have a virtual movement. We don't have much of a material movement. We have movements, or we have things that come up. It could be a police shooting. It could be anything. But we don't get rallied until the event comes up, and that's why we're always behind the eight ball. I mean, Frank mentioned Republicans putting five members on the Supreme Court. Well, that took years of organizing, and so we've got to go back to doing that if we want to win some of these battles.
Frank?
No, I was just going to add that Texas was another example of the crisis. In other words, we do reactive politics as opposed to proactive politics. And he was also saying that we need to focus more on interim politics, not just electoral politics. You know, vote every 4 years, every 2 years, whatever. No, we got to work every day in the interim to build up the organizations and so forth, that when election day comes, you have the power, you know, to make a difference.
You know, when I step back, Attorney Fancher, Mark, it doesn't seem to me that you all are that far apart at all. I think you all are all on the same page. I think you're coming at this from different spaces. How do you respond to what you've heard from Kevin and from Reverend Frank Watkins? Because they're saying that, you know, we're revolutionaries, we're evolutionaries, but we've got to use the system that we've got in order to achieve these ends. What do you say to that?
Oh, no, I think that
Oh, I'm sorry, Frank?
Mark? Change the system we have.
Okay. To change the system we have. Pardon me for misstating.
Yeah, no, I think that we are very close in terms of what we think needs to be done. I completely agree that we need to organize. I completely agree that, you know, we need to, you know, have a vision. But I think where we differ is on the focus. I don't want to organize for the purpose of trying to change or take over the existing system, because I think it is corrupt to the core. I think that it is useless for oppressed communities, you know, for you know, the descendants of enslaved Africans, for indigenous peoples of the Americas, for Latino communities that live in poverty. For all of these oppressed communities, that system, the electoral process, is rigged against them. They have no prospect, no hope for making the changes that they need through that process and through that system. And so for that reason, we need to create a completely different political reality. And, you know, I always say that, you know, if you're a Christian, you have to be a socialist, because the first socialists were the first century Christians. They were confronted by circumstances that are very similar to those that oppressed communities in this country are facing. They were, you know, people of color who lived in first century Palestine who were oppressed by an imperialist power that was based in Rome. And what they did is they did not say to themselves that what we need to do is to try and get involved in Roman politics and to try and use Rome's political system to try and improve our condition. They knew that it was their enemy, that it was their oppressor, that its primary focus, its primary objective was to keep them subordinated, to keep them oppressed and exploited. And so what they did is they rejected it in its entirety, and they set up their own society with their own system. And the system that they set up, you know, to deal with their economics and their politics was a socialist one. I mean, it's all there in the Acts of the Apostles. I'm not saying that we replicate what they did because our reality is different. But I do think that we have to have a broader and better vision that's informed by what we can accomplish and what we need. If we can't find the political allies that we need within this country, we need to look beyond U.S. borders. We need to look to revolutionary and progressive forces in Africa. We need to look to progressive and revolutionary countries like Cuba or, you know, any other country that is prepared to make alliances with us, to provide us with the material support that we need, the international political and global influence that we need in order to accomplish what we need to accomplish, along with any other allies that might be willing to stand with us. That's the type of thinking that I'm focused on rather than how we can get control of the Democratic Party, which I think is a futile endeavor.
Anyone want to respond before I go to the callers?
Well, I just want to know where he wants us to go. If we don't go to the Democratic Party or we don't go to the Republican Party, which doesn't, that's not a real alternative, where do black people and poor people go now? I mean, what wagon do they jump on?
We create our own political reality in whatever form.
Where is that? Where is that being created?
That's what we have to do. We're trying to identify the challenges that are before us and the needs of the people. It is useless to continue to try and find an answer within a system and within a party that has demonstrated that it is our enemy.
Well,
I hear you. I've organized with the Green Party. I've filed lawsuits to protect the rights of third parties here in South Carolina, and I've run as a third party candidate. But the reality is, that most people don't understand a third-party movement. When you even talk about things like cumulative voting.
That's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about a third electoral party. I'm saying a rejection of the electoral political system itself. Third parties don't work because the system is designed to accommodate only two parties that have received the approval of the capitalist class. No third party is going to be allowed to succeed within that system because they need to control both parties. So I'm saying we have to reject the entire system and create a different political reality. That's what revolutionaries do. They don't go and try and work.
The political reality is downtown Columbia, South Carolina, on city council, who decides what roads are paved, what sidewalks are put in, where garbage is collected, what kind of taxes you're going to pay, where you're going to live. That's the reality that most people are having to deal with on a daily basis, and you're talking about creating a different reality other than that for them.
I'm not saying to neglect those the existing system. For those who are skilled and adept at using the system to the best that it can be used, I'm not saying that nothing can be gained from the existing structures. You get from it what you can, but you can't look to that for liberation. If you're looking for liberation and the true fulfillment of the potential and the aspirations of oppressed communities, you've got to reject it. And you've got to plan for something that's completely different and outside of it. You can continue to work in the existing structure and get what you can from it, but you can't say that this is where we're going to find our liberation. We can't. It's designed to prevent us from doing that.
Let me bring in a couple of callers. Frank, before I go to the callers.
Well, I mean, I've never turned the Democratic Party, you know, into my religion, and I haven't turned presidential candidates into my God to worship, which is kind of what the Republicans have done with Trump, and I've never even come close to doing that. I mean, the Democratic Party is a means to an end, as far as I'm concerned. I'm not married to the Democratic Party. You know, so I just see the Democratic Party as a means to, in your terms, revolutionary ends. I don't think there's been a more revolutionary book that's been written than what Congressman Jackson and I wrote in terms of a more perfect union. If you want to talk about some idealism and where we need to be going, much of that is in a more perfect union. When we propose 9 constitutional amendments, that's not exactly a status quo. When we're talking about you have the right to health care and we need to put it in the Constitution, you have a right to a safe, clean, and renewable energy in the environment, we put that in the Constitution. You have a right to safe and sanitary and affordable housing. We put that in the Constitution. The right to vote is not, a fundamental right to vote is not in the Constitution. Voting is a state right. We put a right to vote in the Constitution, and so forth. So I don't know of any more revolutionary book that's ever come out of the United States Congress than A More Perfect Union. So
all of those objectives are worthwhile.
Okay, Mark, before we go to the callers.
Okay, sure.
No. Before we go to the callers, I wanted you to make your point.
Oh, yes. Yeah, all of those objectives are revolutionary and worthwhile and what the people want and what the people need. My only point is that you can't accomplish them through the existing system and the existing structure. You can aspire to them, but the system will not allow for that to happen. We're only going to get that by using alternative means.
David from San Francisco, what say you? You've jumped into the middle of a really, really hot discussion. Love it. David, what's on your mind, sweetie? How you doing?
Yeah, I'm wondering. It just crossed my mind that some of the districts are becoming so unmanageable that electoral politics tries to compete against a theme, but the districts are too large. And I can give you an example for Texas with the electrical grid. They got suckered into something that Enron did 20 years ago. And if you think about the size of Texas, it's so large that it's the equivalent of one-third of the lower 48. And one idiot at the top, or a pack of, a small cadre of idiots at the top, can drag a third of the nation into the ditch. And so a bunch of examples of this have happened. 1914, we used to have a new congressman for every 30,000 people. And in the 1800s, it got bumped up to 60,000 per congressman. Now it's well over 700,000 per congressman because they topped off Congress at 435 members. So we're not getting taxation with representation, and it's all because the districts are intentionally skewered so that representation can't happen. When you look at the tax cuts to the super rich, they basically don't pay taxes, but they get the representation. So it's representation without taxation, which is a big problem. And I go for, I've been a third-party kind of guy, and when you think that the Democrats usually make up about 30% of America, the Republicans are usually about 25%, and the unaffiliateds are about 40%, or third-party unaffiliated, independent. So I usually go with just the old taxation with representation, and you can get a lot more done when you show how these districts are being skewed and find a way to make actual taxation with representation happen.
Hmm. David from San Francisco sending you. It does make sense. Make much, much, much love. Let's go to Shapiro from here in Chicago. Shapiro, what's on your mind as you put up the hashtag, I stand with Mark Fancher?
Yes, I do.
Please explain.
Y'all know I love me some Frank. I love me some Kevin Gray and your whole entire panel.
And
but
Robert.
The reality is, you know, Robert my favorite because he always give me some good clap. So I'm waiting on that. But Santita, we knew who Biden was before he was selected as our nominee. We knew that he was a moderate right Democrat. We knew that. We knew that he was going to govern as a moderate right Democrat, and that's exactly what he's pushing. So all the Democrats said, well, this is who we got, so we have to support him. And now he's reneging on some of the basic promises that he tried to say that he believed in. Well, we knew that he did not believe in any of it. And so at this point, for me, the reason why I stand with Fancher is because we have been doing this over and over and over again. We put the Democrats back in power, we give them control, and then they don't do what they do, which is what they're supposed to do, which is run the damn table. That's what they need to be doing. They need to be actually taking care of the American people at this point. We're in the middle of a pandemic. We have a big job loss. We have people who are hungry and getting ready to be homeless. And we pussyfooting around trying to sit up here and decide what we're going to do. They know very well that $15 minimum wage is not even a livable wage. They know that we need at least $20 to $25 an hour for families to survive in this country. And so the fact is that we are not supporting the American people. And if Democrats do not support us, we shouldn't support them. I'm tired of them. I'm sick of them. And we can sit up here and say, oh, well, this, what other choice do we have? Hell, maybe we need to work with these Republicans. Maybe we can try to sit up here and find some common ground with them. Because guess what? They're reneging on us, too. So we have to realize that we cannot continue to ask for the same thing over and over again and knowing we're not going to get any results with the Democrats. I'm tired of them. If they don't pass this couple of bills, I am not voting Democrat. I don't care what Frank say. I don't care what Kevin say. I don't care if Jesus came down here and told me to vote for the Democrats, they ain't getting my vote. Because I'm tired of them reneging on the promises to the American people. They better stand up. And they better run the tables as if the Republicans, if they had the full gamut, they running the table. We saw it for 4 years with Trump. They didn't care what he did. They don't care what about his corruption. They did whatever he wanted. And I need a Democrat who's going to do whatever the American people want. Pass the damn bill. That's it. Pass it.
Wow.
Shapiro has spoken.
Well, I never thought I hear Frank, Kevin, and Jesus in the same sentence. Wow. I don't know what I'm going to do the rest of the day after that.
I don't either. I never, that's a conflation I never thought I'd hear in my lifetime. Let me go to Robin from Boulder, Colorado. Robin, oh my goodness. I'm having a wig raising experience today with these people, but this has been a great conversation. Robin from Boulder, what's on your mind?
Are you sure 41 million is the majority of, I mean, it's our majority as far as Senate representation is concerned? Because mm-hmm. I thought it would have been higher than that because the state of California is close to 40 million.
Mm-hmm.
So Kamala Harris, I mean, had at least 20 million constituents there. I'm shocked to hear 41 million. I thought it would have been higher.
41 million more. Votes.
I mean, 41 million more. But
not really. When you look at California, Robin, is a very interesting state. It's very liberal and progressive, and it's also very conservative. You got
right.
Pete Wilson and Ronald Reagan out of there. You have L.A. and Orange County.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
California's
no,
and America.
I would have thought mm-hmm. 41 million just sounds kind
41,
of low.
41 million more voters. not 41 million.
41 million.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, yeah.
Well, anyway, I need to get on to the.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Frank, you can clarify, but no, Robin wanted to make her point.
No.
Oh, okay, Robin. No, okay.
Go ahead.
Shapiro is right. $15 an hour minimum wage is laughable. I don't know where wealthy people like Mitt Romney and Joe Manchin and a lot of these other senators get it into their heads that this is, you know, $15 an hour is too high. It would be way too low for them from their perspective. And here's what I think Joe Biden needs to do. He needs to sit in the Oval Office and address the nation on this. And he needs to look squarely in the camera and simply say to all Americans out there, if Ted Cruz is your senator, ask him why he doesn't want you to have $15 an hour. If Joe Manchin is your senator, ask him why he doesn't want you to have $15 an hour. Just really put it into perspective there. I don't know what else Biden can possibly do.
I'm going to say something totally contrary. You know, I run a small business, and a restaurant. We pay some of the highest wages in the restaurant industry in South Carolina. But I tell you, if you're talking about, and I live in South Carolina, a poor state, and if you're talking about $15 an hour or $25 an hour, then you're basically talking about corporatizing business just completely, because small businesses wouldn't be able to withstand that. We wouldn't be able to compete with all the money that the big corporations, the McDonald's, the Hardee's, the Applebee's, the Chick-fil-A's, we wouldn't be able to compete with that. We'd have to shut down and go get a job with one of those companies. And that's the difficulty in that. And when you're talking about benefits, I mean, it would hurt a small business person.
Robin, I've got a minute. And okay. We're going to get, you know
like
what, hold on. Give it to me in 30 seconds, and we're going to talk for a few minutes on Facebook Live as soon as we get off the air. But, Robin, 30 seconds, okay. They belong to you.
Okay. As a property manager in Boulder, Colorado, $15 an hour is not sustainable. It's not enough to keep a roof over your head unless you have to live with a number of other people to
support. Well, hold that thought. Hold that thought, because we're talking Colorado, we're talking South Carolina, we're talking West Virginia. Joe Manchin says $11 an hour is comparable in West Virginia, even though the economist is saying you really need to make upwards of $23 an hour in order to survive in America. So we got to talk about that. Just I want to get some closing thoughts from my panel on the other side of the break. I want to thank everyone for being with us today. We had a wonderful time, so much enlightenment with the good news from Pastor Darius Brooks. Yes, that Darius Brooks, the psalmist, the brilliant Grammy Award-winning singer-producer. He gave us some good news this morning. Of course, Dr. Deborah Holden, COVID-19, giving us the latest information on that. Reverend Frank Watkins, get the book, A More Perfect Union, Advancing New American Rights, and Frank Watkins, Killing Trayvon's, an anthology of American Violence. Of course, what can I say about you, Robert Petillo? Every Sunday from 10 to 1 Eastern Pacific Time, and then 1 to 4 Eastern Standard Time, and of course, Mark Fancher, National Conference of Black Lawyers. I'm Santita Jackson. Stay right here on Facebook Live on the Santita Jackson and Friends page. God bless you until tomorrow. Love ya.